everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. Now, from time to time, I like to talk about animals because when it comes to being about food, animals are a big part of the conversation. And as you probably know, if you've been listening to me for a while, you know that my motivation behind talking about food and my motivation for what I choose to eat today started when I thought about animals when I was a teenager and decided that I didn't want to kill other sentient beings. I started to realize what it was that was on my plate, and not, it wasn't an it, but it was a who, a he or a she, something that wanted to live its life as passionately as I did and wanted to roam freely, make his or her own choices. And that's led me on the path that I've been on ever since. And we talk about health and the power of plant foods. We talk about the environment. But for me, my motivation is the animals. So we talk about animals from time to time. And guess what? We're going to be talking about them right now. I'm going to bring on my first guest, Hope Bohannock. She's got a new book out called The Ultimate Betrayal. She has been active in animal protection and environmental activism for over 20 years and is a nationally recognized leader and speaker in the animal protection movement. Many years ago, while living 80 feet off the ground in a redwood tree so it would not be cut, Hope dedicated herself to animal and environmental causes and has since organizing countless events, demonstrations, and fundraisers. She has led campaigns like getting the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to sign a Veg Day resolution encouraging meat-free eating in the city, and was the Sonoma County coordinator for a statewide proposition to help protect farm animals. She co-founded the North Bay's Compassionate Living Outreach while working as the campaign's director at In Defense of Animals. Hope lives with her soulmate and co-author, Kojin Bohannock, in Pen Grove, California, just an hour north of the Golden Gate Bridge, where they have been blissfully married for 13 years. Welcome, Hope, to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so you've been working at this a long time. Why did you decide to write The Ultimate Betrayal now?
Well, yeah, you know, I have been in it a long time. Like you said, I've been vegan for 24 years.
Woo.
And yeah, and you know, the conversations that I've been having with people about animal agriculture and how animals are being raised, you know, the conversations have been shifting over the last maybe 5 years or so to something different, something new. And I'm having conversations with people, and especially in the area that I'm in. I'm, you know, just like you said, in Sonoma County, north of San Francisco. There's a big movement, the slow food movement, you know, Know Your Farmer and farmers markets. And I think a lot of this is really great stuff. We're really starting to look at our plate and care what's there, and wonder about where it came from. So these are all good things. But something that's happening is people are starting to say, oh, well, you know, but, you know, when I'm talking about animal products, meat, dairy, eggs, they'll say, oh, well, but my eggs are free range. Well, but my meat is organic. And, you know, they almost feel like the conversation is ended, like mm-hmm. the animals are happy, mm-hmm. everything's okay now, you know, and they're doing the right thing. And so I felt that this is something that really needed to be looked into, really needed to be deeply researched. And that's what I did with this book, The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? And, you know, and the thing I want to tell those people is, you know, thank you so much for caring. Thank you for looking into what you're eating and actually seeking out labels and products that, you know, are doing better for the animals and for the environment. But did you know the truth behind those labels? Do you know the truth and what's really going on with those labels? And so that's what I really go into in the book, both ethically, what's happening, what those animals' lives are really like on these supposedly alternative farms, and also the environmental impact. Is it more sustainable? And it's really interesting what I found.
I think there's two things going on here, and it makes our job doubly difficult. And one is the fact that over the last 100 years or so, we've been moving towards all kinds of industrialization, and our food has become synthetic. It's not fresh. It's not real. It's not whole. And many people today are eating foods that have been so manipulated in so many different ways, and we see detrimental effects with our health and with the environment. But the other thing is something that's been going on for as long as I think humanity's been around, at least. Humans have been eating animals. That's something that's been going on for a long time and hasn't changed. And now we're starting to think about it, although there have been cultures all through humanity's history that have had people that have abstained from eating animals or exploiting animals. So our job is doubly difficult now. But the good thing is, I think that, as you said, people are starting to think about their food and where it comes from. And I think it's important, too, to align with those people on the issues that we agree with, getting whole, fresh, locally grown when possible, healthy food, plant food, preferably,
right,
and not
right,
genetically modified, right, and change our food systems around. But now let's get to the ultimate betrayal.
Yes.
So I read your book, and there's a lot of important information in there. I've highlighted a few of it, and hopefully we can get to some of it. The first thing that popped out was the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, fascinating thing that happened. Just recently, there was a group of scientists, neurological neurobiologists, brain and emotion and psychological type scientists that got together, had a conference, a big summit type event, and they actually they documented what you just said, the Cambridge, I don't have it in front of me, but what's it called again?
The Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. It's a mouthful.
Yeah. Thank you. And what they basically were saying is that animals have the same cognitive abilities, the same emotional capacities as humans.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, groundbreaking and really amazing. And it comes from just this body of science. I mean, all these scientists have done all these different studies, and they all have come together now saying, look, this is the findings. This is the declaration. Animals have the cognitive ability and emotional capacity just like humans. And something that's happened in the last maybe 10 years is that we're finally realizing that animals suffer.
Yeah.
That they're not just automatons, they're not just, machines. No, they are feeling beings that actually can experience pain as we do. They can suffer like we do. But this is a step further. This is actually saying that they have the emotional capacity to feel misery, to be sad, to be joyous, to be celebratory, all those things that we think are uniquely human. No. Now science is saying that that we need to open that circle up in our minds to animals as well.
This is information is hard to swallow, figuratively and literally.
And
I think we see it with our companion animals that people like to call pets, the
right,
animals that some people choose to live with. Many people realize the personalities that their companion friends have, and all the emotions that they feel. I mean, many people know this, even people that eat meat, and then you wonder, why are they not connecting the dots? I think it was
right.
You quoted Captain Machado, I think, who talked about killing dogs is a felony and you get jail time, but then killing hundreds, thousands of cows, you get a paycheck.
Absolutely. Well, there's some kind of, many, many people recognize that dogs and cats have these emotional capacities that, you know, they know that when they come home, their dog gets excited and happy. They know that when they're about to go out on a walk, the dog is all excited, so it's anticipating the future happiness that it can have on that walk. There's lots of emotion and rich emotion going on with the dogs and cats. And people, but somehow we have put farm animals in a different category. And of course, this, what does this do? It makes it easier for us to exploit them, easier for us to eat them. And people really believe that somehow farm animals don't have the same capacity for, you know, for these feelings, emotions, and rich, emotional lives. And, you know, and it's just this, I don't know what, a disconnect, something that we've been able to put them in this category. And even to the extent in our laws, you know, we have comprehensive animal cruelty laws for cats and dogs, like you were saying, Captain Cindy Machado of the Marin Humane Society. She's been there over 20 years, and she sees it all the time that, you know, what someone could never get away with and would be, everyone would be horrified for someone, the way they treat a dog, you know, abusing a dog, but then they do the same kind of horrible things to farm animals, and, you know, and it's overlooked. It's considered an agricultural exemption, that's often what it's called, or reasonable care standard, meaning that, you know, some kind of procedure in animal agriculture is necessary. It's commonplace to making a profit on that product. And it's, but because of that, it's not considered cruel in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the local, you know, animal control. But it absolutely is cruel. And we have exempted farm animals from those standards, both, you know, both in the law and just in our own perception.
In your book, you go over lots of different terms, and I wanted to touch on some of them because they're important. And you mentioned in the beginning of the show as well, there are people, conscious consumers, whatever they may call themselves, where they feel like they want to know where their food's coming from, and they want to know that if they're eating animals, they've been raised well. So we hear terms like grass-fed and free-range and humane.
Yes.
What do these things really mean?
Yeah. Well, I go into extensive detail on each of these labels in the book. And, you know, and each label means different things. And there's a wide range of variances from, you know, the conventional standard factory farm to a more small scale, you know, more this supposedly humane farm. There's so many variables in between, but something that all these farms have in common are these inherent cruelties that you just can't get away from. Yes, some of them may give them a little more space. Some of them may have them out of the cages, but that's not the only misery that these animals endure, and it's not the only hardship of their lives. A good example would be Clover Dairy. It's a very popular dairy here in the Northern California, Oregon, Washington area. And Clover Dairy, you know, they very much use these buzzwords. They tout themselves as local and humane. They are actually, they have the certified humane, American certified humane label, which is supposed to be the best of the best as far as humane goes. I talked extensively to one of the managers at Clover Dairy, and, you know, I asked her, so, well, what happens to the calves when the calves are born? And she said, oh, well, they get taken away. Mm-hmm. And I said, right at birth? She said, oh, yeah, you know, right at birth or soon after. And I said, well, you know, wouldn't you consider that cruel? I mean, this poor calf is going to have to be torn from its mother. The mother who just carried this baby is never going to be able to experience that bonding and love. I mean, that's, you know, an extreme cruelty. And they just don't see it that way. Not necessarily that they don't see it that way, but they have to do it. They have to do it to make a profit. They have to sell that milk. There's no other way to do it. It is inherent in the industry. So there's these inherent cruelties that they'll never be able to get away with, or away from, rather. And, you know, and also the baby males. I asked, well, what happens to the baby males? Of course, the females are going to be separated from the mother, but then go back into the dairy industry. What about the baby males? they're a waste product. They don't give milk, so they go to auction, often for veal, sometimes just for meat, but, you know, and certainly not in another certified humane someplace. You know, the industries are so, unfortunately, you know, reliant on the cruelty and the way things are. There's just no way to make a profit. And the human cows go to slaughter within, you know, five or so cycles of years of having babies. You know, their body begins to be depleted from all the intense, strain of pregnancy after pregnancy, and then they're going to go to slaughter as well. And that's maybe the equivalent of their teens. I mean, these cows could live to be 20 years, but they're going to slaughter at four. So there's so little difference, in a commercial operation and these supposedly certified humane operations. There's things they cannot get away from. And also, I want to point out labels that we're talking about, you know, local, grass-fed, all these. There is so little regulation and so little oversight on these labels. Most all of these labels, all a farmer has to do is fill out a form. And they fill out that form, and they send it into the USDA, and the USDA gives it a stamp of approval and sends it right back. No one goes out to the farm to inspect. No one goes out to see what's really going on. You know, there's so little oversight. It's very sad.
So who did you write this book for?
I wrote this book for two people. I had two target audiences, and the main target audience is, of course, people that are seeking these alternatives, that hear about the factory farming and are concerned for the animals, and they're going to Whole Foods and they're going to Trader Joe's and they're looking for these labels. They're, you know, wanting to do something better. And I really want them to know the truth and to know the whole picture and not just to hear what that company has to say, because that company is trying to sell a product. And they're not going to give you the whole story of what happened to those animals. So I want to give that story and give the truth behind those labels. So I wrote it for them. My secondary audience, though, is definitely vegans and vegan activists, because I want us to be informed of these things, because the conversation is shifting. We've got the factory farming talk. We've got that stuff down. We've got those talking points. We know, that's free. This is a new story and a new way that that animals are being raised and that things are being labeled. And so I'm hoping that, you know, they'll get good information. That I have in the book, I have wonderful scientific studies, great stories of the animals themselves, some animals that have been rescued from these farms, from these small-scale farms. And so they'll have stories and science to tell when they're talking to people about these issues.
Yeah, I agree that for the second audience there, the ones who are already with us, the activists, this is a great read to have information in their pocket to give to people, because a lot of other people are going to be talking about slow food and humane farming. And this is really important for them.
I've actually had a lot of, you know, vegans and vegan activists tell me that they learned so much, you know, that they went into the book thinking that they probably would already know a lot of it, but that they learned a lot, because it really is kind of a new world with all these labels. So there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, there definitely is. And I love the stories. And it's so important to include individual stories about individual sentient beings. These aren't individual people stories. These are individual animal stories. And they're really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
We just
have
a couple minutes left, and I wanted to talk about some of the good news. So you mentioned that meatless or meat-free products grew 21% in the last couple of years from 2009 to 2011. Very encouraging.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And actually, if that trend continues, we could see, if that exponential growth rate continued, 80% of America would be vegan by 2050. I mean, so exciting and so amazing. And I mean, you know, who knows if that could happen in that kind of a growth rate, but it's really pushing forward. And I also talk about how, I've seen just personally such an amazing shift in the 24 years. Back when, you know, when I first went vegan 24 years ago, you know, all there was like powdered soy milk that you had to add to water, you know, and it was chalky and terrible. And if you wanted a cookie, you had to bake it. I mean, there was nothing. And now it's everywhere. We've got vegan donuts. We've got, you know, everybody knows the word now when you go into a restaurant. We've come so far in such a short period of time.
There's really no reason not to do it, because the food is absolutely delicious. And even if you choose to eat a very health-promoting, plant-based, clean diet, the food is delicious. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely. And everywhere. Yeah. You can find it everywhere.
What's your website so people can find out more about your book?
Yes, it's the title of the book, dashes in between the words, so it's www.the-ultimate-betrayal.com.
Okay, very good. And just before we go, I just wanted to mention one other item, that Democrats and Republicans, this goes beyond party lines. There's an equal number of vegetarians between them. So that was really, really encouraging to
read. Isn't that awesome?
Yes.
I know. I love that. There's something that we can all agree on.
That's right. Say hallelujah. Thank you.
Animals be treated with respect.
Yes. Thank you, Hope, for joining me. And it's all about food. I really enjoyed your book and wish you all the best with it. We're going to take a quick break and be back in a moment. Stay with us.
Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and it is the middle of October, October 15, 2013. Lovely, lovely fall day, sunny. It doesn't even feel like fall here in New York City, actually. It's been pretty moderate, lovely weather. My favorite time of year. How about you? And there's some really fun foods to eat around this time. We're getting into those heartier, heavier things. I've been playing around a lot with beets. You can't beat them, right? I get a delivery of produce with a particular business that I subscribe to from time to time, and they bring organic vegetables every week, and we're getting a lot of beets. And I don't know. I guess some people can eat beets all the time. I kind of have to be in the mood for them, and sometimes I throw a chunk into my green juice or just steam them up and have them ready to slice in salad. I was a little adventurous and made a borscht soup last week, which I've made them from time to time over the years, but this was a slightly different variation, and it was surprisingly wonderful. I added a little barley miso to it because I had read that some borscht soups had a beef stock, and I like to go to miso, especially the darker ones, when I want that heavier, meatier texture or flavor. And this was an incredible mix. I'm constantly surprised about the mixing of different flavors and foods, things that you would never think would go together, and then you put them together, and they're either good or they're not good, but when they're good, it's really good. I haven't posted that recipe, but I will get to it sometime soon. All right, let's get on with the show, shall we? So we were just talking about some really serious stuff with Hope Ohanek's book, The Ultimate Betrayal, and I commend her for putting all of that information together. So useful. And I appreciate people trying to do the best that they possibly can in their lives, especially when it comes to food. And I think if you're going to put the effort to look for foods like organic milk or organic eggs because you think the animals are going to be treated better and the food is going to be better quality, can't you go that extra step and not choose them at all and go for the plant options instead? This book gives you all the reasons why you should, because even though we want to believe those animals are treated better, they really have a pretty miserable life. And now there's no reason not to eat an entirely plant-based food, and we're going to find out a little bit more about that in just a moment, because there are so many fab alternatives. And One of the things people say when you mention that Jay should give up dairy is that thing called cheese. Everybody loves their cheese. Oh, I can't give cheese. There's cheese addictions. And we've got some good news for you. So I'm going to bring on my wonderful next guest, John Slim. He's got a new book out called Cheesy Vegans. He's an award-winning author of 15 books on cooking, entertaining, history, how-to, and fiction. He holds a master's degree from Harvard University and travels the country speaking about cooking and entertaining. He lives in Pennsylvania. Welcome back to It's All About Food, John.
Hey, Karen. It is so exciting to be back with you and all of your great listeners.
Thank you. So what have you been doing? You've been talking to a lot of people. You were just talking to Mary Lou Henner. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. I how lucky am I to get to talk to both you and Mary Lou Henner on her show earlier today, all in one day.
All in one day.
Yeah, and I'm doing Victoria Moran's show tomorrow. So
oh, nice.
I'm three of my favorite ladies in 1 week.
Oh, thank you.
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I really am.
Well, I hope the last program went well and that you've got more energy to go to talk more about your cheesy vegan recipes.
Oh, absolutely. It's always so fun talking to you. And I really appreciated the last segment you did. You know, for me, it's all about the animals. You know, the delicious food is a given. You're always going to find that in my cookbooks or else I wouldn't be writing them. But I really write them so that on some level, those animals out there know that we're thinking of them and that they're not alone. So, you know, I appreciate hearing interviews and hearing about books like that.
Yeah, well, I'm with you where I want to think about the fun things. I want to think about the joyful things and the delicious food that's out there, but I can't forget why this all started and why I really do it. And it's a hard thing to think about. I find that when I do kind of open my soul to the reality of what's going on, I can't take very much of it in, frankly.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm out there on the lecture circuit. I do a lot of the veg fests, and I do not do cooking demos. You know, in fact, they've luckily stopped even asking me to do cooking demos because I love to get up there and I talk about the whole concept of embracing compassion, whether it's through tasty activism, like, you know, eating delicious plant-based food. And yes, it can be delicious, and yes, it can be fun. But, you know, it's really about, at the end of the day, letting those beautiful animals know that we're right there with them, and we're trying to make a difference in the world for them. And, you know, it's always a thrill when I'm out on the road to get to talk about them. And, you know, I delivered the keynote at Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary about a week and a half ago. And, you know, just to be able to literally jump in the pig pen with those gorgeous pigs and give them a big hug was just such a thrill for me.
Well, what's exciting, I was looking at your schedule, and you've been pretty busy talking at a variety of different places, but what's exciting is there are so many of these events. Some of them are large and some of them are small, but there are veg festivals popping up all over the place.
It's great. It's really great. And what I love about it is it speaks to the heart of grassroots efforts, which is what we are all about, you know? And so I'm always thrilled, whether it's a small new event or a large established event, I'm always thrilled and so honored to be invited to speak. You know, at the beginning of the summer, I spoke at the very first Rehoboth Beach Veg Fest. So it was great to be there at the dawn of what's going to be, for years to come, a great Veg Fest there. And I just emceed DC Veg Fest, which, you know, those people, they've been around a while. They're creating the blueprint for how you do a Veg Fest. So it's just so great. You know, such a great mixture of positive energy and compassion.
Now, I'm assuming that there are more younger people at these festivals.
No, it runs the gamut. That's what's so exciting to see. You know, I think, you know, there's this stereotype out there, especially among, like, non-vegans and vegetarians, that they seem to have this, like, image of the granola-eating hippie. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I know a few granola-eating hippies, and I love them to no end.
It's an amazing image that has persisted. I don't know why. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not the case anymore. You go to these veg fests and you meet every age group, every socioeconomic, you know, it just goes right across the demographics, and it's so great to see. And, you know, with the cheesy vegan, I am starting to hear stories from a lot of parents out there who are telling me their kids are getting in on the cheesy vegan action. Because my recipes for making the cheeses are so simple, kids can actually get in the kitchen, do this with their parents or whomever. and they're having fun. So they're learning about quality time, they're learning about good, healthy food, and that just sends me right over the moon. I love that.
Okay. We're going to get to your book in a moment, but there's a number of different vegan cheeses that exist on our planet today,
yes.
And I've got them in three categories. So one is the kind that we see more and more in health food stores and in some regular supermarkets. They're different varieties. For the most part, I give the companies that are making those cheeses a lot of credit. I personally don't care for any of them. It's just a personal thing. And for some people that have are transitioning and really find it hard to live without cheese, some of them have really helped them. And it's just something about having a fatty, salty plop of something that gets soft on whatever it is they're eating that feeds the addiction or is comforting, whatever it is. So there's that. Then there are the kinds that you can make at home, and we're going to get more into that because these are my favorite kind, and they're easy, and they're fun, and they're just fabulous on so many levels, and we're going to get back to it. But then there's this game-changing thing going on, which we haven't really seen yet, but there are some very special people out there working in laboratories that are taking these nut and seed-based milk bases and adding cultures to them and making cheese like cow cheese and sheep cheese and goat cheese have been made for centuries and thousands of years. And they're making them now out of nut milks. This is very exciting. It's fascinating. And I'm really curious to see where that's going to go. It's kind of hard to do that at home, although I did talk to Miyoko Shinner when her book came out, and I've done some of it at home, but it's very, very time consuming.
Yes.
Have you tried any of those?
Well, you know, I did, as you can imagine, a lot of research, extensive research when I was writing this book, and, you know, some of the vegan cheese recipes out there, and you can find tons on the internet. You practically need a chemistry degree.
Yeah, well, I have one, so that's why I go into it.
Well, I do not, you know, so those things go right over my head. I would need you to come over, and I should have called you up, because I'm trying to figure out some of these recipes, and I'm like, I don't even know, I can't even pronounce some of these words, let alone figure out what I'm making, and I'm like, that is fine for the people in the labs who are, like you said, hopefully creating some really delicious cheeses that we're going to enjoy in the years to come. But for my cookbook, The Cheesy Vegan, I wanted to bring vegan cheese home to Main Street for all of us to enjoy in really simple and easy recipes that even kids can make. And so that was the priority for me in this book. You know, I'll leave the chemistry up to all of you chemists, which we certainly need chemists in the world. I'm a huge supporter of that.
Well, for food that's mass-produced, there's a lot of chemical engineering involved, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but it's definitely out there. And one of the scary things that I found about making these things at home, because I would make like a yogurt with a probiotic culture, and you leave it out on the counter or in a warm environment, and you can do this for days, and this stuff is growing, which is what cheese is all about. But I'm thinking, you know, is it clean enough? Am I doing the right thing? And it can be scary, and I didn't have the test equipment to see if I was growing anything that I shouldn't have. So, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong, and there are things that go wrong in the cheese business, where there's all kinds of things that they have to check for, and sometimes cheeses get out that and dairy products get out that have a lot of dangerous things in them, and now we have a government shutdown and no one's inspecting. And
oh my, I know. Well, you know, and I think the complicated recipes that are out there, whether it's for vegan cheese or some other vegan dishes, it gives everything, all the work the rest of us are trying to do, a really bad name. And I think it has from the beginning, because people think, vegan food, plant-based food is weird, mysterious. At the end of the day, it's tasteless, it's blah. You know, I always say, I think non-vegans and vegetarians still think that we all eat something akin to hummus smeared on cardboard using these weird ingredients you can only find in a health food store, I don't know, on Mars or something. And, you know, from the very beginning with my first book, The Tipsy Vegan, and then Grilling Vegan Style, and now The Cheesy Vegan, I've been determined to smash through those silly and ridiculous stereotypes and create recipes that I call small town friendly, because I live in a small town, and so I want my friends and neighbors here to be able to go to our supermarkets and occasionally the liquor store, of course, and find, you know, pretty much all of the ingredients they're going to need. And, you know, if there are a few ingredients that may be new to some of the readers, I give them either homemade versions of those or easy online sources door-to-door where they can order them. But those are very rare and few and far between. But I think it's good to also introduce readers, whether it's in small town or anywhere, to a few new ingredients. We all need that. But, no, the days of complicated recipes need to be behind us, certainly where I'm concerned.
Okay, the thing that people love about cheese is, as I mentioned before, the salt and the fat. And there are so many things that are so unhealthy about cheese, cholesterol and the bad saturated fats and a whole host of things that are in dairy and other animals' milk products that we shouldn't be consuming. Anybody, even the animals of those species, don't consume their own milk as adults. And there's a lot of cruelty involved and there's environmental degradation. Okay. Your cheeses are practically guilt-free. They're made with primarily whole ingredients that have great nutrition, and you're also getting the salt and the fat, but it's all good food. So let's jump into that. Now, there is one mysterious ingredient, and we need to talk about it a bit, and that's the magical ingredient, agar.
Yes.
Let's talk about agar. And why do people say agar, agar sometimes?
I'm not sure why people feel the need to say it, other than, you know, it's such a bizarre word, and sometimes it's fun to pronounce it twice. So I'm not sure, you know, agar, agar. It sounds actually like a Halloween word, since the season is upon us. Maybe, you know, the new costume this year should be, you go as agar, agar.
Oh, that's what I'm going to be for Halloween now.
Right, it's going to be the hottest costume. Let's do it, and let's see how we interpret that into a costume. At its most basic, it's a powder, or it comes in flake form as well. It's a vegan gelatin, and as we know, the gelatin that we have all sort of known for decades is not vegan for a lot of reasons that we probably don't even want to get into, but I think if people, you know, did a little research, they'd find out what really is in regular gelatin.
Cartilage, bone cartilage from animals.
Leave it to the chemist.
Yeah, right.
I'll let you. Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely disgusting when you think about it. And there are, a lot of ingredients like that. Refined table sugar has what? Animal bone char in it, and most people don't realize that. So you just got to be so aware. But the agar, I'm really thinking of costumes now.
I'm thinking of? You mentioned powder and flakes, but I've bought the long strands of agar from our Chinatown stores. I don't know if you've seen that. They're like long, long, almost noodly, and they're really hard to manage. But I'm thinking, what a great costume it would make. Kind of like a weird cousin It wearing all this white, long, stiff strands.
I want to see photos of you dressed as this Halloween. I will be expecting a tweet on Halloween from you. You know, yes. Again, that's one of those new ingredients that I have introduced. I think a lot of longtime vegans and probably vegetarians will have heard of it and be familiar with it, but it is going to be new to some readers. It's basically used as a binding ingredient to hold a lot of the other ingredients together in the cheeses. It has no flavor in and of itself, but I think it's, you know, once you get used to working with it, you're going to be, the readers will use it in more than just the vegan cheese recipes. You're going to start seeing a lot of other recipes where you can use it in as well.
And it can be tricky to use. You really need to get the right amount to the right liquid to agar amount, and sometimes if people are using flakes and the recipe calls for powder and vice versa and they're not using a weight scale, they might not get the right amount.
That's right. And so I tried to, you know, make sure that I was very specific when it's best to use the powder in some of these cheese recipes, flakes, or if you can use either or, that's laid out with the exact measurements. And, you know, speaking of chemistry, making cheese, you know, the recipes are easy, but just like in baking, it's a little bit, it's chemistry. I mean, cooking is chemistry, and in some cases, you really do have to be pretty precise in the way you follow the recipes. And I think with vegan cheese, it's like that. You want to stick as close as you can to the actual cheese recipes. Now, when you get into the 100-plus food recipes in the rest of the book where you can use the cheese, you know, you have a little more freedom with some of the spices and herbs and other ingredients. If you want to add a little more, a little less of this or that, you have that freedom. But when it comes to specific things like making the cheese or, again, in baking, you want to be sure that you stick pretty close to the recipe. You know, I've heard that, from people around the world, actually, because I just did this great thing on Google Plus called Vegan Mainstream Cookbook Club. Mm. And I was their featured author last week, and different people from around the world said, we don't have pimentos where we live. Mm-hmm. What could we use in some of these recipes where it calls for it? And so I said, basically, you know, the easiest thing would be some roasted red bell peppers. You know, there's nothing like a pimento, but, of course, roasted red bell peppers is basically the same, and it's delicious. And so they used it, and they found that it worked pretty well. Some people, one woman, she can't eat cashews, which appear in some of the cheese recipes.
Right.
Now, she's not allergic to nuts. She just cashews causes an issue. So she substituted a combination of macadamia nuts and pine nuts.
Mm, delicious.
Delicious reason. I can't wait to try that now. I'm like, I wish I would have thought of that. That sounds incredible. You know, of course, macadamia nuts can be a little pricey. And, you know, we like to keep the recipes to a, at least to a price point where they're as accessible as possible to everybody. But this, it just goes to show how creative people are out there, and especially the home cooks. They're just getting better and better, and I love it.
All right, so just give us a basic idea on how it works. I know there's a lot of different recipes, but what do people know? What do people need to know on how to make these things? So before they go out and buy your book, they're forewarned or prepared as to what it takes, because it really is pretty simple.
Yeah, well, you know, I can simplify, honestly, and I can only speak for my recipes. Otherwise, go get a chemistry degree before you go out and get some of these other recipes. I can't vouch for them. But I can simplify my cheese recipes down to four words. Mix, blend, set, eat.
No, I like the last part.
Yeah, well, that's everyone's favorite, right? My favorite, too. But it really is that simple. You're going to find that these recipes do not have a lot of ingredients, and basically you're mixing some of them, you're blending some of them, you're putting it all together, and you're letting them set from anywhere, depending on the cheese, from 1 hour to maybe overnight, and I specify that so you know if you're going to have to start a day ahead. And then you just eat them. And it really is that simple. Mm. And, you know, people just don't believe it until they see the book and say, these are really simple. And I'm like, it couldn't be any other way with me, because I'm just not going to get – I want anyone from the first-time home cook to, you know, the seasoned top chefs out there to be able to pick up this book and just run with it and have – because it's about having fun. You know, like I with my other books, this is meant to be a party in a book. Check reality on page one and just come along with me and let's have fun.
Okay, so your cheeses, some of them have cashews in them as the fat base. Sometimes you use tofu. I noticed you have this mozzarella recipe that I love, which was made from oatmeal and tahini. Very surprising ingredients. And no agar.
Yes, so you know, agar isn't used in every recipe. The recipes, so, you know, someone who might be a little freaked out by that, you know, doesn't have to feel that they're going to have to get acquainted with agar mm-hmm. so soon. They're going to be able to try some other ingredient combinations and come up with some really great results.
Now, where did you get these recipe inspirations? I know that my first vegan cheese recipe I got from Real Food Daily with agar, and I've been making variations on that ever since. Did you have any inspirations, or did you just start from scratch?
Well, you know, I did, like I said, research extensively mm-hmm. all the different recipes that are out there, to the point that I was literally dreaming vegan cheese.
Yep.
And the idea was, how can we take, you know, let's look at all the cheddars and how have these vegan cheddar cheeses been done? And frankly, how are, you know, dairy cheddar, you know, I researched a lot about how dairy cheeses are mm-hmm. created. And how can we take those components all together and really simplify it down to the easiest way to create a delicious cheddar cheese, mozzarella cheese, Swiss, you know, all the standards are in here. And that's really how, you know, and I say we, I work with a really great test kitchen team that I've assembled. You know, you mentioned I've done 15 books. About 10 of those have been cookbooks. You know, I wrote cookbooks even before I was vegan. So over the course of my career, I have, you know, really gathered a great team around me, which is really important to have, and really to get those down to those core ingredients that would be easy and understandable for everyone to create.
Mm. Okay, so we've got the cheeses, and you have a lot of different variations of them. Some are harder, some are softer and spicier and winier. And
and by wine you mean not a complaining cheese, the actual, you know, you can never take the tipsy vegan away from me. Once a tipsy vegan, always.
Right, and smoked, and it's like what we do with all our vegan recipes. It's all about the flavorings that make our food delicious. It makes all food delicious. If you add some smoky flavoring or some horseradish, and there's just so many wonderful flavors that go so well with fat.
Isn't that true? Interesting how that works, right?
Yeah. And then you come up with all the comfort recipes afterwards, that what people can do with these cheeses.
Yeah, I mean, there's an entire chapter dedicated just to mac and cheese. There's an entire chapter dedicated just to cheesecake, but which, of course, that was a no-brainer. Those two absolutely demanded their own chapters. But then you'll find everything from breakfast and brunch, snacks, soup, salads, right on through supper. Every occasion is covered. I really want this cookbook to be something that people can use on a daily basis if they so choose. And, you know, one of the parts of the book that I'm hearing the most about really is the extensive pairing chart that I put in the back. And again, you know, it's the tipsy vegan coming through, but I took each of the homemade cheeses and really by association the rest of their dishes throughout the book, and I paired them with suggested red and white wines, beer, classic cocktails, and really other spirits. So you can take cheddar, for example, if that's what you're going to make, and you could pair it with a Chardonnay or a Merlot or a great lager or a gin martini. Mm. So I outline that for people who really want to, because, you know, today the hottest way to entertain is to do a tasting with either beer or wine and whatever food. And I get to do that quite a bit, and so I wanted to put that in the book and so that people can do that and, of course, go off on their own tangents in a million different directions. And I even put where people can do a vegan cheese of the month club with their friends, and so I outline an entire year of suggestions for what you could make in January or February or March, maybe divide it up, and 1 month you make the cheese and have us all over, the next month I'll do it and have you all over. Fun. That's what it's all about.
This is not about deprivation.
No, this is about fun and indulgence. But at the end of the day, you can feel good that in, you know, eating food that is good for you, you're also spreading more compassion to the world and really sending a great message out there for all of our animal friends. And, you know, all of the dedications in each of my three vegan cookbooks, they're all the same to all the animals, so you know that you have not passed this way unloved.
Oh.
That's so important.
Yes.
To me. Because there's not a day that goes by, I know for you and certainly for me, that our hearts don't break about those animals. But, you know, we can send them love, and this is one way I can do that.
Okay, a few things I learned in this book. I did not know what nooch was.
Yes, the street name for nutritional yeast.
How did I not know that? What street is that on? Nooch.
Well, and you know, that is why at the beginning of the Cheesy Vegan and all of my vegan cookbooks, I do a really detailed vegan pantry section, talking about all of the different ingredients used throughout the book, such as nutritional yeast, because again, that's one of those ingredients someone new to the plant-based lifestyle might be like, I don't know what nutritional yeast is. Well, they can go to my pantry section and easily find out what that is. Agar-agar, that actually leads off the pantry section.
Well, what I was surprised to find out, now, I love nutritional yeast, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get into the swing of things and call it nooch, but I'll do my best. But I get 5 pounds at bulkfoods.com. And I store a lot of it, but I like to have it on hand, and it's so much more economical to buy it in the big volumes rather than buy the little 3-4 ounce sizes in the store. And I didn't know that bulkfoods.com has agar, so I'm going to have to check that out. I learned that from your book, too.
I know. It's fantastic, right? And for any of your listeners who aren't familiar with nutritional yeast, I have a hard time saying nooch as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always afraid I'm going to mispronounce it and it's going to come out somehow strange.
Fancy. Yep.
But nutritional yeast is really fantastic. You know, obviously, I use it in the cheeses and some of the dishes, but it's really great just to sprinkle on a salad. It shouldn't be confused with brewer's yeast or any other kind of yeast.
Right.
But it has a really great earthy, cheesy taste that you can just sprinkle on any kinds of food, and just adds that cheesy little kick very quickly.
Okay, a couple of other recipes I must mention. Now, I'm a big fan of tempeh Reubens, and you have a beautiful Reuben recipe with your real vegan Swiss cheese.
Yes, and that was a no-brainer because I have always loved Reuben sandwiches, and of course it was something that I had to let go, which was fine. And I'm like, why do I have to let go of it anymore?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let go of it anymore. I want a Reuben sandwich that we can all enjoy. And this is a sandwich that, you know, with the tempeh and the vegan Swiss, that your more carnivorous pals out there are going to love. You know, and that's the thing about, you know, my recipes. These are recipes written for everyone to enjoy. You know, in the beginning, I had some people come to me when I started the book, and there was a discussion, and, you know, all these discussions go on. How are you going to spell cheese? And I'm like, well, well, what do you mean? And, you know, and so they're, well, maybe you should put a Z at the end or a Z-E. And I'm like, no, that's not how you spell cheese. That just makes it look like you're trying to get away with something. I'm not trying to get away with anything. I'm creating cheese.
That's right.
This is cheddar. This is Swiss. This is mozzarella. They're all cheese. Just because they don't happen to have dairy, that does not mean they're not cheese. These are cheese. And, you know, I just did an interview with an NPR station out in Wisconsin, which, you know, is right in the heart of dairy country.
Ooh. Yeah.
It was fantastic. I got such a great response from it, and, you know, and we talked about that. And I'm like, look, you know, you have to sort of look at these cheeses, say my cheddar. Well, in the dairy world, we all know what cheddar tastes like, but you have a lot of different brands of cheddar. Well, guess what? Some of those brands of dairy cheddar taste a lot better than others. This is just consider this maybe the John Schlimm brand of cheddar. It's just another cheddar that's being put out there. We don't have to, you know, specify that this is plant-based or vegan. You know, I think people feel they need to make excuses to their friends when they come over and say, oh, this is vegan. You don't need to do that. It's delicious food everyone's going to enjoy.
Right. Well, That's language for you. I mean, I'm thinking as a feminist, when we have to qualify, normally you go to a doctor, but if she's a woman, then you say, I'm going to a woman doctor, and you always have to kind of add these adjectives to kind of apologize or explain something that isn't what is considered normal. And then we do it with cheese or with butter. Everybody says vegan butter, but in some ways you want to say that, or at least in a restaurant or somewhere where you want to know the food is vegan, you want somewhere that it clarifies that. But there have been lots of arguments from companies that make milk about soy companies calling their product soy milk, because the dairy people thought that they had this ownership of the word milk, which is ridiculous, because we have mother's milk, human milk. We have coconut milk. There's a lot of different milks out there.
And that's right. Well, I would say to them, have you asked a cow their opinion?
Yeah,
I think
really.
They'd be okay with us calling almond milk and rice milk and soy milk milk. I think they'd be perfectly fine with that.
Okay, so we have a minute left, and I didn't want to end without mentioning your fried olive stuffed with smoky cheese hummus. This is a crazy rich decadent dish.
Well, you know, the great thing about that dish, I am in the midst of working with a local university here, the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford, and this semester, three classes in their hospitality management program are incorporating the Cheesy Vegan Cookbook into their curriculum.
Wow.
Which is so exciting.
Yeah.
And none of these students are vegan or vegetarian.
So, wow.
But they're learning about it. So not yet. Maybe they will at the end of this, but they're throwing a big tasting at the end, and that is one of the dishes they're serving at the tasting. And I'm like, this is just so cool that, you know, the Cheesy Vegan is becoming part of a college curriculum. And that means that, you know, it's just one more step forward.
That's right.
In this, but yes, that dish it's delicious. The smoky hummus, even on its own, is fantastic. But you stuff it in some olives and fry them up. Yum,
yep.
yum, especially
I'm
the holidays.
I'm saying party. That's party time.
Yes.
John, thank you for joining me. It's always a pleasure. And thank you for creating all of these wonderful, delectable, delicious recipes for us to enjoy, compassionate and cruelty-free and all of that gooey good stuff.
You are most welcome. It is always a pleasure. And I will be watching for that Egger costume.
All right. I'm going to get working on that.
One of the listeners out there will do it.
Okay.
It does. I want to see that.
Great. Well, people can check out your website, johnschlim.com.
Yes.
And there's a few consonants in there, but it's johnschlim.com. Okay, thanks for joining me, John.
I'm
Karen Hartglass. We've come to the end of the show. And visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And remember, let's say it all together. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.